This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to this CIO market update from LGIM. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Jason Shoup, Deputy Head of US Fixed Income, visiting us from LGIM America in Chicago, and Tim Drayson, Head of Economics. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the pod.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi, Max.
Well, our last podcast in this series back in August feels like a lifetime ago. While our focus today is on the US, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention recent volatility in UK assets, in particular, the gilt market. Sonia, it's an incredibly fast-moving situation, so perhaps without dwelling too much on the specifics, which are likely to have changed again by the time this podcast goes live tomorrow, what do you think this episode tells us about the broader investment environment?
Thank you, Max, and a very warm welcome to our listeners. Quite the understatement to say we'd be remiss not to discuss the UK, because very clearly it's been quite a few weeks that we had to go through here. And before going into more detail what actually has happened, it's definitely worth embedding this into the broader context, because clearly we have been grappling all year with an ongoing, you know, pricing of monetary tightening. And it's very clear that since the beginning of the year, central banks have continuously had to change their communication in order to prepare markets for ever higher interest rates, simply because it turned out that inflation was far stickier and in particular the structural elements of inflation far more prominent than originally anticipated. So in this context, obviously, markets have been repricing since earlier this year and have clearly adjusted to the expectation that interest rates have to go up a lot higher, because central banks have been very clear that they would do, using Jay Powell's words, whatever it takes, pretty much, to rein in long-term inflation expectations. Clearly, it has been quite a painful journey, particularly in global bond markets. What happened then in the UK over the past 2-3 weeks kicked off with the announcement by the government of the so-called mini budget, which turned out to be a large fiscal program. And as such, the market got scared because there was too little detail that they could look at and to understand how this fiscal program would be funded, and as such led to a significant acceleration in the sell-off in the long end of the gilt curve and in the so-called index-linked market. And it's mostly, and this is very important, not the fact that we have seen higher interest rates. It has been the speed of the adjustment process on the back of the mini budget that clearly caused a lot of stress in the UK market, and that is still dominating not only the narrative within the UK market, but will be going forward, because clearly there have been a number of Bank of England announcements, and we're currently working with our clients to make sure we can adjust to this. Again, this is not unique just for the UK. Overall, obviously, globally, we have seen inflation being the dominant driver and the shift in central bank policy being the dominant driver of markets this year, because we should not forget that the 10 months or so that we have seen now in 2022 with a dramatic shift in monetary tightening is against the backdrop of literally 15, 20 years of very supportive monetary policy. So we have to expect that the faster the adjustment process, the more potential strains will emerge. And as such, we probably should prepare for greater volatility and more volatility when and if we see this happening because of the way central banks are reacting. Now, growth is the other element, and clearly the market has been, you know, balancing in between the inflation scare and the potential risk of recession. And clearly we are still seeing that both will be dominating the headlines, but it's probably the twin impact of both these risks that are creating extra volatility and uncertainty. And again, not just within the UK context, but clearly a global phenomenon.
Well, thank you for that perspective, Sonia. Let's turn to Jason now, moving to the midterms. What exactly is happening on the 8th of November, and why is that important for global investors?
Absolutely. Well, thanks for having me. November 8th is the U.S. Midterms, which I guess is less than 30 days away now. I've started to check my calendar and lost track of times. All 435 seats in the House will be up for or be contested, and about 35 of the 100 seats in the Senate will be contested this go-round. Thankfully, it really only comes down to about 30 races in the House and about 10 races in the Senate in terms of determining which direction we might go. As we all know, over the last 2 years, Congress is very evenly divided. It's probably the most evenly divided it's been from a balance of power perspective over the last 20 years. So we know the Senate is 50-50, but while the math won't support this, I would almost make the claim that the House is more evenly divided. It's only a 9-seat margin in favor of the Democrats, right? And so the possibility of change to the status quo is quite high, right? We could see the Republicans take back control of either the House or the Senate. And the question is, why does it matter for global investors? Why isn't this just a U.S. Issue? And I dare say there's a bit of a parallel to the UK events of the last few weeks, right? At least from the fiscal side, right? And if you step back for a bit of context here and you think back about the debates that have been had in politics and in economics over the last 2.5 years or so since COVID, it's clear that there's a very active debate on sort of where has all of this, above trend inflation come from in the U.S., right? And I'm sure Tim here will have quite a bit to say about this. But if you're in U.S. politics, one of the debate is very germane to how you want to talk about, the next few years and what you might want to do if the U.S. does head into a U.S. recession. The Dems, you will be unsurprised to know or find out, really believe that much of the inflation that we're seeing even today is really supply side driven, and it arises from many of the bottlenecks that we've seen globally and now start to get resolved. The Republicans, as you would imagine, put a lot of emphasis on the fact that much of the government sort of support and emergency measures ended up producing excess demand in the economy. And while this may seem, all of the question of the last 2.5 years, it applies to sort of the next 2 years in terms of what sort of, governmental fiscal type of measures you might want to deploy as if the U.S. is in a much rougher spot from a growth perspective. And so as we kind of fast forward to today, if the Dems are able to maintain control of both the House and the Senate, I think you will find out from Tim that you get a very different fiscal outlook for the next year and a half in the U.S. At a time in which I think one of the lessons from the U.K. is that in an era of the Fed and other central banks hiking rates, there potentially is a lot less fiscal space to use, right? And so, clearly that will have a bearing on all sorts of financial assets if we do go down the route of the Democrats holding onto the House and holding onto the Senate. It will matter for inflation. It'll matter for where the Fed goes and what they're able to do in terms of providing support to the economy. Government yields in the U.S. will be certainly something that we'll all be focused on as well, the dollar, et cetera, et cetera. And finally, the last two things. So I've focused mostly on the fiscal. There are two other issues that are worth thinking about in terms of what their impact might be from the midterms. One is corporate taxes in the U.S. Raising the corporate tax rate has been a plank of the Democratic Party for some time. They've run into some opposition within their own party because the Senate is so evenly divided from the senator from Arizona, Sinema. So if the Democrats are able to increase their number of senators, possibly that opposition is no longer there. And that's something that we could see change. And then the other one is energy and sort of green policy in the U.S., right? And it's the same story.
Thank you. That's a fascinating overview, some really important context there. If I could just ask, what's your base case scenario for the election and how might that impact dollar assets, in particular credit and rates?
Yeah, it's a great question. I managed to not tell you sort of where the odds are, right, in my previous response. So a little bit of a divergence. If you look at the polls these days, oftentimes you'll see things are quite balanced, right, between in terms of which way this election could go. And there's this old phrase that a week is a very long time in politics. Certainly that is true. Months are a very long time in politics, too. And if you just turn back the calendar, you know, a few months, all of the debate was around Supreme Court ruling over the summer, and it had skewed the midterm elections and the polls towards the Democrats' favor quite decisively. Since then, you won't be surprised at all to find out that the renewed focus on the economy, the renewed focus on oil starting to rise, given what OPEC Plus has announced recently, has tightened the market once again. Right. And so, as I said, we're most concerned with the probability that the Democrats are able to hold on to the House, hold on to the Senate, and basically maintain the status quo and perhaps even add to their advantage in the Senate. That's the most market relevant outcome. Everything else is gridlock, which usually isn't great for the U.S. economy, but it's easier to understand, less uncertainty going forward. We think that there's probably around a 20% chance that the Democrats are able to maintain the status quo, which is a quite large tail risk to contend with and think about. And when I think about what that means for U.S. markets, if we were to see the Democrats succeed in that way, I think what the really interesting question is sort of your outlook on yields, right? And going forward, in the sense that we may be headed into a U.S. recession in the next year or so. But yields right now are at the highest level they've been in for corporate credit, for instance, in almost 15 years. For euro credit, it's certainly in the last 10 years. For sterling credit, you could go further back. And fixed income as an asset class is suddenly looking a lot more interesting, right? If you don't get a Democratic sweep, and if you do get the base case sort of 80%, you get some sort of gridlock or some sort of mixture of the Republicans controlling one portion of Congress, it seems highly possible that you could be seeing a very good entry point from a yield perspective into fixed income markets in the U.S. Where you might get concerned is that scenario that I outlined earlier, which is where the Democrats win both and then are able to do something very aggressive on the fiscal side over the next year. And you're not at all certain where yields might go, which is something that everyone in this room, I think, can understand.
Right. And your mention of a possible U.S. recession is a great segue to Tim. Tim, I know your team has just published its latest roadmap of economic forecasts. What do you expect from the U.S. economy and the Fed in the coming months and over 2023?
So the outlook for the US is better than Europe. Unfortunately, that's rather a low bar. In contrast to Europe, the US is self-sufficient in energy. It's got an abundance of natural gas. But right now, I think the economy has got reasonable momentum. We have seen a fall in prices at the pump since the summer, notwithstanding the OPEC Plus output cut that Jason mentioned, which is starting to lead to prices creep back up again. But we're still around about 20% lower. We've also seen continued robust employment gains and strong wage growth. So this is all supportive for household incomes and spending in a run-up to Christmas. Now, the downside, of course, though, is the inflation backdrop. We've got persistent inflation problems, particularly in services, and that's why the Fed is continuing to embark on this very aggressive hiking cycle. So looking at another 75 basis points, this will be the fourth consecutive 75 basis point increase. Don't think many economists predicted that at the start of the year. So remember, monetary policy operates with tremendous lags. The impact of this tightening is not yet evident in the economy. Some sectors it shows up relatively quick, such as housing. We've seen quite an abrupt downturn there. But in other areas like business investment, it takes a few quarters to really filter through. So yeah, Jason's already mentioned the R word. I do think there will be a recession next year. Our forecast call for a 1% drop in output peak to trough. I mean, it's relatively mild by historical standards. But that's potentially a positive development, at least on the inflation front, by adding some slack into the labour market. We should see those wage pressures diminish. And I'm hopeful once we get through 23, the Fed will then be in a position to reverse course and we can look forward to some growth returning in 2024.
Right, and how might the midterms affect your view of the US economic outlook?
So I thought Jason covered this really well. It's all about the Democrat clean sweep. That's when you get potentially radical shifts on fiscal policy. You're much more likely to get a fiscal response in a recession if the Democrats control Congress. If we get a split Congress, I think the Republicans will be quite resistant to giving that fiscal support, unless the economy were to really deteriorate much more rapidly than anyone expects.
Well, that's a very clear answer. Thank you, Tim. Sonia, as Jason alluded earlier, climate change certainly features prominently in the US political discourse. And by happy coincidence, the midterms are actually taking place during COP27. What are your expectations from this year's climate summit?
I'm sure someone has planned for it to coincide in order to fuel the debate in the US. But if you think about COP26 in Glasgow and COP27, the backdrop could not be more different and more difficult, particularly with regards to climate change. COP26 obviously has been probably the most international, the most watched, the most publicized event in the COP series. And there clearly has been, I think, a much stronger support from obviously the corporate world in order to capture the topic and show the responsibility and the involvement. Now, ever since, obviously, the geopolitical events have really not shifted the narrative, but added an additional layer of complexity to it. And this is particularly true here in Europe, where governments have to balance energy security with a desire to reach net zero in the desired timeframe. And that clearly has been the far more dominant topic for most governments. Not that they're trying to shift away, but if you are the German government, you clearly had more pressing issues and reduce the dependency on Russian oil and gas in order to establish energy security level that probably has never been there. And you would hope that COP27 will obviously acknowledge this and raise the awareness of the required investment, because I think if we recall the results from COP26, there clearly were, let's say, a few wrinkles of what hasn't been addressed, and where clearly there needs to be greater alignment in the way how governments and corporates and on an international level, we can achieve those targets. And so this will be interesting to see how the geopolitical events feature in the debates and how, there hopefully is even a greater emphasis, because that's the opportunity, and not only having a more transparent articulation of the problem statement, but then obviously a very clear understanding how to address it, because it's very obvious that for particularly the European countries, we probably see a deterioration first before we then see a sharper improvement, simply because they will need energy sources that are have a higher carbon intensity in order to deliver the energy security that's required. So I would definitely think that's featuring very highly. Carbon tax, I'm pretty sure, will come back, because in order to be clearer in the global problem statement, as we always said, you need to quantify the problem first in order to come up with the right solutions. The imbalance between the developing world and the developed world, again, was a topic last year. I don't think has been addressed to an extent that is satisfactory. So again, I would assume, given that it's taking place in Egypt, that this might be more prominent this year. So definitely lots to talk about, and hopefully picking up where COP26 left it, but with even greater urgency, simply because of the awareness now due to the geopolitical events.
Well, that's a great perspective. And of course, next month we'll be gathering to discuss how much has been achieved at COP. And of course, that question of how we can decarbonize and secure energy security at the same time. Well, Jason, building on your response earlier, do you think the risks around the midterms and the economic trajectory are mispriced? And how is the team positioning in US credit into year end and beyond?
I think a lot goes into formulating your credit view, right? In your view on markets in general. And politics is only usually one small bit of that. I do think, as I mentioned before, that the polls have been under scrutiny for the last half a dozen years here in the U.S. in terms of their accuracy, both probably worldwide as well. That they show a tighter market here
than is likely to be the case. And part of that is just that when you're doing a poll, for whatever reason, you have a number of Republicans who tend to not respond to the poll. So you get non-response bias in the poll. So some of the struggle we have is, do we trust the polls or do we trust prediction markets, right? So from our perspective, we do think that that clean sweep odds are, as I mentioned, only around 20%. We aren't hinging our entire opinion of the credit markets and what we should be doing in portfolios over the balance of this year on that basis at all. We do think, I think this is the easy answer, things are going to stay volatile until the end of the year, probably. As I mentioned before, probably the most interesting thing is potentially looking at fixed income from a pure yield perspective at this moment. There's no reason why the best yield entry point has to line up with the widest spread entry point, right, in corporate risk, from a corporate risk perspective. And I have a sense that we may be close to the best yield entry point, but not necessarily the best spread entry point, right? And so that means that if you're looking to generate income, could be a great next quarter to think about how to do that in your portfolio. If you're looking to limit the risk of downside and from credit defaults and credit weakening, you might need to wait until next year.
Okay, I detect a sort of whiff of optimism in your answer just now that again sets Tim up very, very well for at least the first part of my next question, which is, what gives you most cause for hope about the global economic outlook and most cause for concern, which is less optimistic, I concede?
This might be a somewhat strange answer, but some good can come of a recession. And what we don't want to do is repeat the errors of the 1970s, where inflation became embedded in the system, inflation expectations ratcheted higher, and it required a much more devastating loss in output to restore credibility. But some squeeze on demand now will hopefully reset inflation down and maintain inflation expectations at target consistent levels. So that's the first positive. The second positive is that downturns have an element of cleansing and creative destruction. So one of the critiques from economists of the kind of post-financial crisis era was the rates were too low. It allowed so-called zombie companies to continue to exist. With a recession, some of those less viable businesses close down, and hopefully the resources can then get allocated to more efficient areas and potentially faster growing areas in the future. And then the final benefit of recession, it just reminds us of the risks out there. So it leads to more prudent lending and investment decisions for the future. So that was the optimistic stuff. Okay, we're going to maybe didn't sound too optimistic. On the negative front, I'm watching developments in Ukraine with great sadness. I am worried about the potential for this to escalate further. I'm also worried about energy security, something that Sonia touched on. I mean, this winter is going to be difficult. I understand why governments are trying to provide a protection for consumers, particularly most vulnerable. But the economist in me is saying, well, if we don't let the price signal destroy demand, we're in risk of over-consuming energy this winter. And then that could lead to outright shortages and rationing, which leads to greater output losses than would have been the case if we'd all just reduced energy consumption. So that's my greatest concern.
Well, thanks, Tim. There are definitely some rays of light there amid some of the doom and gloom as well. So thank you for that. Well, Sonia, as always, we've covered a huge amount of ground today. What are the key takeaways for investors? And is there anything you'd like to add?
Yes, absolutely. And I think from both what Jason and Tim have said, it's very clear that the situation remains still quite fluid, and there's still a lot that markets need to digest in terms of politics, geopolitics, and obviously the outlook for growth and inflation that aligns to this. But I still think that actually the adjustment process that had to happen on the back of the dramatic shift in monetary tightening is still the most dominant factor that will drive markets. And I think what we have experienced here in the UK is showing just the impact this has on market participants and where you can see strains happening. And it's just the awareness of how to navigate this and an understanding of the events that will unfold, particularly, obviously, eventually we will assume that we have seen a peak in rates, at least in terms of the understanding where central banks will have to head towards. And it will be all eyes on the growth outlook. How bad will the recession be? But I think, as Jason has said, it's understanding what this means and then thinking about, obviously, the opportunity set, because, we will get through this. And at the end of the day, there will be an adjustment process structurally. And again, this is something we are very much focusing on, understanding the longer term structural implications of the situation we're finding ourselves in, because there will be opportunities, investment opportunities arising on the back of this. I think we would all agree that in an environment of lower expected returns, the alpha, i.e. the selection of individual securities, will be far more important than the pure beta consideration of investing in a market. And I think that is something clients should bear in mind when thinking about their existing portfolio, the asset allocation, whether they are sure they understand the risks they have in their portfolio and whether it is still time to adjust. But clearly, with so much going on, it is important as well to understand when we might find a turning point in markets on the back of quite a lot being priced in.
All eyes on that turning point then. Well, look, finally, I'd just like to ask you all what you've been watching, reading or listening to recently. I'll get the ball rolling and say I've been listening to an audiobook of Count Belisarius by Robert Graves. It's historical fiction, all about a valiant Roman general trying to hold up the Eastern Empire in late antiquity. And it's a real page turner or ear turner. Sonia, what have you been?
Very difficult to top that one. Slightly lighter, given the intensity of the past couple of weeks. I've not indulged myself with very heavy literature in the evening and have read a crime story in German that actually plays in Frankfurt. And given that I've lived there, I always like to read where I actually know where it's happening and the reference to kind of local sites.
Oh, great. What's it called?
It's Nele Neuhaus, and the title is Schneewittchen muss sterben.
Great. Well, look, for our German readers out there, you've got a recommendation now. Thank you, Jason.
More somber for me. Recently lost a colleague in the services for her. This book was mentioned, and I've just started it. It's been very good. It's called When Breath Becomes Air, and it's by a neurologist it's his memoirs, and who gets diagnosed with terminal cancer, right? And so, it's good focus away from work sometimes to think about the bigger things in life.
Absolutely. Thank you, Tim.
So I've been spending a lot of time watching the continuous news cycle, but in order to try and escape and switched off rather than do more reading, I've indulged myself in various sporting activities. So cycling, golf and paddle tennis to take my mind off things.
Very important. Good. Well, that's a great point on which to end this month's call. Thank you, Sonia, Jason and Tim, for your time today. Thank you to you, our clients and listeners, for joining us. Our next edition of the CEO call will be in November, when, as mentioned earlier, we'll be joined by Xuan Chan and Nick Stansbury to talk about COP27. In the meantime, you can find our latest updates via our social media channels on the Elgin blog and, of course, here on Elgin Talks.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties, and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website. Copyright 2022. Legal and General Investment Management Limited. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, including photocopying and recording, without the written permission of the publishers. This material is issued by Legal & General Investment Management Asia Limited, the license corporation BBB 488, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission, for professional investors only.